Given that we have an advantage of interacting with the department much more than we do. However, we apologize that for an unexpected time constraint that we've been placed on our program due to the later event in the house this afternoon or today, where, of course, the Minister of Finance will present medium-term budget policy statement. Also, the main one, the Springboks, we, as Parliament, we have asked Springboks to come to Parliament to honor them. Now, unfortunately, we've got to be in the house at 12 o'clock. So it's going to be a very brief presentation, not presentation as such, but it will be an engagement. Members, you would really recall that we've never had this before, but we've been asked to, before getting or engaging the annual report, but rather to invite stakeholders to come and get their views. And being the first exercise experience, I think next year it will be well prepared and to have much more stakeholders, much stakeholders as we can. And today with us, members, we have only two presenters. I don't know if somebody from FEDUSA will be joining us because they confirmed that they will be around, but maybe Tony will, I don't know if he may know. But with us, we've got Mr. Tony Ehrenreich. I don't know, Ehrenreich. Well, you'll pardon with me if I don't pronounce it. And of course, Mr. Mkhize, who is well known to us, who are going to make just a brief presentation or the input. And of course, I must welcome Dr. Rupna Rain from the IFG, the new member of this committee. I hope, madam, you are going to really assist this committee and be with us. I'm sure you're going to enjoy the committee. Welcome to the committee. And without wasting more time, can I just give over? I don't know, Babu Mkhize, with you, Tony, who is going to be the person, but I'm sure Babu Mkhize is an old person to us, will just give us a brief input. And then we'll see, maybe if we have time, if FEDUSA people are here, then we will also give them an opportunity. And then members, we will just engage while during this, but we'll see how it goes. Naloma Zikada, over to you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson of this committee, Honorable members of this committee. I think it sounds a bit unusual when we receive the invitation, since this is the first exercise. We were not sure how to approach it ourselves, but here today we will improvise. I think the first thing that one... I think one would have to improvise in terms of just making a couple of comments without taking a lot of time, because I think what would be useful for us is the engagement in this way. Now, I think my starting point is that We do not have a Department of Employment in this government, but we have a Department of Labor. Often the question is asked as to who is it really who is responsible for creating employment in this country. By default, the Department of Labor is often looked at as a savior, so to speak, in terms of taking us out of the unemployment quagmire in this country. So I think to a large extent the department has been creative, and it has shown some creativity in terms of how to deal with this difficult challenge of creating employment. So the first sort of challenge for us is that who exactly is responsible for job creation in South Africa and in government. Now, there have been anecdotal statements made that to a large extent one wouldn't expect trade unions to be creating jobs. In fact, it's entirely outside of their province for trade unions to be creating jobs. So if it is not trade unions who are supposed to be creating jobs, is it business that is supposed to create jobs? There's a popular view out there that indeed business should be seen as the responsibility of creating jobs. But how do you find the balance between creating jobs on the one hand and doing what business is charged to do, the business of business being business? So you do get caught up. So if it is not as succinct as that in terms of business being the ultimate or bearing the ultimate responsibility of creating jobs, then who is it? Is it government? Now, to a large extent, the government is one of the largest employers in the country, and therefore the responsibility to create jobs and this work as it relates to the public sector, that's where government actually kicks in. So having interacted with the department and some of the creative ideas that they've come up with, I think we're faced with a new challenge right now. I mean, the challenge is about the world-class labor legislative framework that we have in this country. I mean, we've had comments from the likes of the IMF, the likes of the World Bank, that perhaps the labor legislative regime in this country would fit in best in the first world or in a developed economy, not an economy like ours. As a result, the metaphor of having a royal choice in the middle of Burundi often comes up, that our labor legislative regime is so advanced that we are basically ahead of our time. Hence the call for labor market flexibility. Now, we've been seized with this issue. The department is responsible to lead the discussions and ideas in terms of how do we deal with this dichotomy that and two extremes, basically, that on the one hand, we all rave about our labor market legislative regime as being world class, but there are sort of unintended consequences that are beginning to emerge. The question of labor market flexibility on the one hand, but on the other hand, with the labor movement complaining that there are huge gaps in the current labor market legislative framework. So on the one hand, the labor movement is calling for tightening of the labor market regulatory regime. On the other hand, the private sector of business is basically saying we need to revisit some of the good things that we have in the current labor market legislative framework, with a view of finding the balance, with a view of dealing with the unintended consequences. So this challenge resides squarely within the department. And the department has done some work in this area, but it's going to be very hard to find this balance of on the one hand, ensuring that the labor legislative regime in this country continues to provide the basic objectives of why we have legislation in the manner that we do, whilst on the other hand addressing any possible unintended consequences.
So it's an issue that is firmly on our agenda. I mean, one of the key challenges for us is how does one deal with the casualization phenomenon, which on the one hand is a global phenomenon. It's not only peculiar to South Africa, but globally, the question of casualization and the atypical forms of employment is an issue that all of us are grappling with. It's been sitting on our agenda at Netflix for quite a while now, and that is indicative of how difficult the issue is. Very complex issue. And in fact, you have two distinct extremes in that on the one hand, labor is sitting in one camp and government is sitting in another camp. And the whole effort is to see if we can't find the middle road. So we've got to move fairly quickly in terms of dealing with these issues. But we can't deal with that in isolation to the broader labor market policy review to see if this labor market policy has indeed become an obstacle for stimulating or unleashing the potential economic growth in this country to 6% and even beyond. So we're trying to be grappling with the view that is it an obstacle in any way? If it is an obstacle, where is it an obstacle? And where is it that we need to be looking at with a view of alignment and so on? So that's my view as a challenge for us. I think the fourth challenge is that by default, the first reforms of this country by this house was on labor market. I think that's where we saw a lot of reforms, we saw a lot of new legislation being finalized, and it was particularly around labor market policies. And it is our view that it was not an accident, but it was by design that labor market policies were the first to see the light of day. For a simple reason that the labor market policies of this country were the cornerstone of the past. So if you really wanted to accelerate transformation in this country, you had to start in the workplace. The workplace is where it begins to mirror, and it tends to have an impact in terms of how the society is engineered and so on. So that becomes absolutely critical. So how do you then defend the labor market policy legislative regime that is not a pure workplace instrument, but it's an instrument that is attempting to do many things at the same time? On the one hand, you're trying to address the issues in the workplace, but on the other hand, there are bigger societal legacies, societal issues that this legislation is attempting to address. It's for that reason that the IMF and the World Bank and all the other outsiders, when they look at our labor market legislative architecture, they don't understand why it's designed the way it is. Because for people in Europe, the labor market legislative regime is an instrument that must deal with workplace issues. But when they come to South Africa, this legislative framework is much broader than just the workplace. It's only when you walk them through some of the context and the background that in actual fact, this is not just an intervention in the workplace, but it's an intervention in the workplace that is also attempting to deal with the issues that are often outside of the workplace. And hence issues like the employment equity. Employment equity is much, much bigger than just dealing with workplace democratization, as it were, and or dealing with the inequalities and the leadership of the past. But it's also attempting to deal with other issues vis-a-vis skills development and so on. I think the last two comments for me is that there's a lot that we could learn from the past, and there's a lot that we could draw from the international experience in terms of how does one begin to take forward some of the issues within the department. Now, often there's a subtle tension between the macroeconomic policy framework and some interventions in other areas, and how the Department of Labor locks in to those bigger initiatives. So if you look at the government program of action, the current one, for an example, it is quite interesting that in some clusters you don't see the Department of Labor, when in actual fact, the Department of Labor should cut across all clusters. given its responsibility. Now, which then brings in the issue of coordination within government much broadly. I think the classical example was the Social Security and retirement funds. I mean, if you look at that particular issue, quite clearly, it does talk to issues across the board, across all clusters. But to what extent are the various government departments interacting with some of these propositions? How do you deal with Social Security, a comprehensive Social Security system, without taking into account the issues that reside within the labor market? As a classical example, to what extent does the UIF talk to a comprehensive Social Security system? It's an issue that must not just be by the way. It's an issue that needs to be fused with whatever strategy that we might be designing in terms of taking forward some of these issues. So the question of coordination within and among the clusters and between the clusters becomes absolutely critical in terms of how the labor market policy issues, the Department of Labor, begins to interact with those issues. So that will be the issue of coordination. And my view is that the Department of Labor should be present in all spheres, or in all government clusters, in terms of articulating a more labor market perspective into those issues. For the simple reason that we have chronic unemployment situation in this country. I think my last point really relates to the question of revisiting some of the labor market policies. It's not going to be an easy task. It's going to be difficult. Now, you'll remember, honorable members, that the current labor market legislative framework in this country is a deal. It was a 100% agreement that was reached in Nedbank between the Department of Labor, which in this case is government, organized business, and organized labor. So it's a deal. As it were, all of them, with no exception. All the labor market policies that we have and the various pieces of legislation that we have were all deals. So it was an agreement of mainly the three parties in that land. Now you could imagine the challenge it would pose for us to go back and say we want to change certain things. Because the nature of this deal was that a concession that was possibly arrived at in Chapter 1 of the Act, you would not necessarily find a trade-off in Chapter 1, but you would find a trade-off in Chapter 6. So if you tinker, if you begin to have a problem with some of the issues in Chapter 1, you need to remember very quickly where was the trade-off. So if you tinker with one chapter, it has the potential of unraveling the entire Act or the entire deal. So it's difficult in that sense. And also, I think secondly, it's in the nature of negotiations that you don't win all your issues. You lose some, you win some. Aren't we opening up an opportunity now for those who lost, or who thought perhaps they lost some of the issues in the negotiations when the Act was reviewed, as this was previously, an opportunity now to reopen discussions on those issues. So it's a tricky exercise for one to manage. And it gets influenced largely by factors that are way outside of our influence as the institution. But having said that, we're looking forward now to the last term, 2008-2009, which will give us a signal in terms of whether or not we've achieved all the objectives, as it were. The engagement we've had with the department, we are very much on track on a number of issues that are on that five-year program, and the 2008-2009 financial year is going to be a tough one for us because we want to achieve as many issues as we possibly can. The question of CETAs, skills development, are some of the issues that come to the fore. The fact that we now have the National Industrial Policy Framework, to what extent does the labor market policy framework talk to some of the objectives in there. So there's going to be a lot of alignment, and some of the alignment is going to be very painful because it's going to call for change, that we've got to change the way we do things.
so that at least there is some degree of resonance between the labor market policy framework and industrial policy framework and its program of action, as it were. So it's going to be quite tough in trying to deal with some of the alignment issues. And of course, the temp settlements are going to come out, and we'll have to just watch them quite carefully. Chair, I think briefly that's the kind of comments I would make at this point.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Mkhize. Members, I'm sure you've realized that Mr. Mkhize has touched more on Program 4 about labor policy and, of course, labor market program. And talking about those four challenges that the department, they feel that the department has. And I don't know if you do have some questions of clarity or an input or around that matter. As I've said, this is just an engagement between us and the presenters. And I must tender an apology of the business constituency. The two people who are supposed to be here, one is abroad and the other one has got a bereavement. So that is why we don't have a representative from BUSA this morning. Do I have any, Mr. Zondeki? And Dr. Rubna Ray, in that order? I wonder in terms of recording, will you be able to reach?
Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to Mr. Mkhize, I think, to remind us about the role of the department in this whole process. Sometimes we do confuse these roles and we end up confusing everybody else, and I think that was very good just to refresh our memories. But I think what I would have wanted Mr. Mkhize to talk about is, given all these challenges and the role of the department, and then looking at the performance according to the annual report that is in front of us now, what are some of those challenges directly towards the department that you can highlight from the department, especially the capacity of the department to deal with this very difficult thing that you've talked about? Thank you.
Thank you. And also that you said in South Africa the legislation is much, it's broader, much more broader than other countries. Maybe I think you did explain that, but one would love to hear more of that. Thank you, Dr. Rukna Ray.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd also like to thank Mr. Mkhize. I mean, it's my first portfolio committee situated in this context. We keep referring to labor market flexibility. I think, every newspaper, most of the speeches, what exactly do we all mean by labor market flexibility? Because you also said we need to revisit the labor market legislation. Is this talking to labor market flexibility? Is this the answer to labor market flexibility? And when you said revisit legislation, do you mean that certain aspects of this legislation have to be amended, or, and if so, which aspects? Thank you so much.
Mr. Mkhize, followed by Mamkis.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I just want to really welcome the presentation from Mr. Mkhize. I think the way you made the presentation is engaging. And I think that maybe we will need also to engage on that. You are raising the issue of don't you think that the labor market regime in South Africa is more flexible than flexibility? That is because of the trade-offs in terms of negotiations. Also, the workers did not even match. And you can find that perhaps business won't match in the negotiation process. Which, for me, would mean that our labor market condition is more flexible than flexibility itself. That is the first thing. The second issue, we are raising an issue of channelization, which is a serious challenge in South Africa, because it talks to the heart of employment relationships. Now, if South Africa, through the Department of Labor, has been a master of drafting employment relationships for ILO, what makes it difficult for us? What makes it difficult for us in the country to make sure that we legislate those things on the ground to deal with issues of labor brokers, to deal with issues of generalization? Because I don't think it's going to be fair to the workers that the issue should be in the table of neglect endlessly. Because if you can go to factory shops today, go to any factory shop, you find people, what do you call them? They have shifts. No security. You understand? When you get unemployed, you just go out without even benefits and so on. It's unfair to the workers. So that is why when I'm raising the issue of flexibility, I also use the issue of employment relationships. You know, as something that was taken by business, you know, at the expense of the workers. I think that. I also want to for you to illustrate on the tensions of the government. The tensions between the macroeconomic policy framework of the country and how government coordinates itself. Because I want you to make a take that whether business in South Africa is really interested or is showing an interest of creating jobs. Because the issue of creating jobs now in the South African context is relegated to government. I know. We agree that government should be the driver of development. We agree. We accept the question of the expanded public works program, but what is the responsibility of business? Because we find that when business wants to be on board, they always want to be paid by government to be on board on a number of issues. Let's take the question of the skills, the Skills Act in the country. We subsidize business to give skills to our people. As if they give skills to our people, they are not making it for themselves to make more profit, because they will have a productive working force in the country. So I want you to enter in this debate about them.
Thank you, Ms. Rajbhavi, followed by...
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also want to express my thanks to the Minister for bringing home some thoughts. My question is that, as you said, that the Department of Labor should cut across all classes and it should be present in all spheres of government. How do you feel about this? Should that be the case? Do you think it will increase the potential of labor in our country? Thank you.
Thank you, Mom Jesus. Dr. Anthony.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
I really don't know what's happening today. Really, there's a sabotage. I don't know why can't we. Yeah, they were waiting on it this morning. Is it because they are preparing there at the house? I don't know. But let's try. Try the other one, Ms. Anthony.
So, Madam Chair, let me welcome this input by Professor Mkhize. Just to fast track the question of labor market flexibility, I just need to check whether there is indeed gaps in our labor market policy framework. If there are gaps, in which area have we identified these gaps? So that we begin to try and engage on those areas and begin to find a solution to it. The question of labor market policies as an obstacle to growth, as an obstacle to job creation. Maybe you need to just expand more in your input around that one so that you can identify and pinpoint key issues of engagement in those areas. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Labuskasa.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, and thank you for our presenters on the other side of the aisle. I found the comments extremely interesting. Also as a new member of the committee and instructor. But I know this is sort of a first experience in getting outsiders or public hearings to interrogate the annual reports. A lot of issues raised would be part of a broad debate, obviously, which we could have on many facets of our situation. I must say what I would have preferred to have seen, so I'll put it figuratively, is that Mr. Mkhize and any of his colleagues, you know, have now sat down and read the annual report and sort of, you know, you read the report and you underline things and you make a query sometimes and a tick on the others as you go through the document. And then come to us and say, you know, I've read this document now on page 4. They said this, well, we have these questions or comments around page 4, item 3, that causes us concern, or your graph or your statistics on over there don't really gel with our information. I think there's something missing here, you know, because that would be to interrogate the annual report, which is our task. As I said, I mean the whole facet of labour. I mean, there's just been a big conference last week on skills. So, you know, those are very interesting and important issues. I'm not minimising them. But I must say that our task here today, I see as this is the annual report, you know, and either it's pretty good, but there are two or three things that I have either a concern or a compliment or a query about. I would have preferred sort of that type of approach, because I said that's our task. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Labuskasa. Can we take those for now?
Okay, I'm going to, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm going to attempt to react to some of the questions, but I think it's important to indicate that I presented this to provoke discussion. These may not necessarily be the views or the collective view of the NetTech constituents, but some constituents and some of these things are up there in the public domain. They are quite familiar to you, a lot of them. Let's start with the last question. I appreciate your preference, and in fact, time permitting, that would have been an ideal way of dealing with the task at hand. And I grappled with that question in my own head before coming here. What is it that would add value to the policymakers? Is it going through the history, or would it be to perhaps flag a couple of key challenges going forward? I chose the latter. Maybe because I'm not an auditor, I'm not particularly keen to look at the history. But of course, the history does inform us in terms of going forward. So we chose that, the route that I chose, specifically because of time constraints, because the report is also fairly big. So I said, look, let's just pick up and lift out of the report some of the key things that we may have to be seized with as policymakers and lawmakers going forward.
So excuse us for that. But what we can do, though, is we could give you written comments on the report as members, because we'll have much better time to do that. So our apologies, sir, for not having the issues the way perhaps that would have helped. Labor market policy regime is an obstacle to growth. In fact, it has given rise to a number of unintended consequences. What are we talking about here? Because that's a loaded statement. What is it that has given rise to people concluding that the labor market policies in this country have become an obstacle? We don't know what this is. As a result, the president, as you recall earlier, on commissioned studies to try and lift what are these things that are obstacles in the current labor market policy regime. It was conducted by independent academics from a range of institutions. And it was quite a nice mix, because in there you had academics who would normally articulate a business view. You also had academics who would often articulate a labor viewpoint in there. So it was quite a nice mix. The first report was presented. I must tell you that it was quite hard to pinpoint in concrete terms what is it that was the problem with our current labor market framework. I think at best, Chido raised the issue of proceduralization, over-proceduralization of the dispute resolution mechanism, for an example, as an obstacle. But nothing really like hard-hitting. Nothing equal to the amount of noise about the labor market being a problem. Nothing specifically. I mean, even in instances where some academics would expect them to really shake the cake, really rock the boat, there was really nothing that hits you, that was in your face, that says we made a huge blunder by legislating the labor market regime the way it is. Nothing huge. So because it was hard in the first attempt to try and understand what the problems were, the president then gave the task to the Minister of Labor. Say, well, can you try and make us understand, can you synthesize these reports so that we can begin to understand exactly what is it that has been raised there, that is new, that we don't know. So the Minister of Labor then conducted roundtable discussions, ministerial roundtable discussions with the stakeholders, including the net and social partners. And what came out of that session was a list of issues where, in most instances, net and social partners were saying, we can strengthen the law here, we can revisit here and tweak some of the issues here and there. But the biggest problem, or the biggest thing that was raised as a problem within the current labor market policy regime, was dispute resolution. This was the only issue that came up quite. Dispute resolution in South Africa. That was the only area that was raised as a major problem. Now, within this context, it was a problem within the context that it has become difficult in South Africa to dismiss workers. It's become extremely difficult and costly because the processes are long-winded and it's quite hard to dismiss a worker, which has an impact on the appetite on the part of the potential employer to employ. Because once you're employed, you're stuck with that worker. And that way, it's very hard to dispense with that worker. So that's one of the things that came out quite hard in terms of the cost of doing business in South Africa has been aggravated by the nature of the labor legislative framework that we have. I think that's on the one hand. There are not many issues that have been behaved as real problems, but we are looking at those issues, and I'm not privileged to raise some of the issues that the constituents have raised as issues that we need to deal with, because we're still very much in the engagement mode, as it were. But the one thing that came out quite hard was it's difficult to dismiss workers in South Africa, hence the lack of appetite on the part of potential employers to employ. In fact, that's also the comment that was made by the IMF when they were asked the same question that you're asking us, what is it in the current labor market system that suggests inflexibility? And by and large, I mean, the issue of the disability commission was an issue that was raised as one of the key issues, as it were. But there's a whole host of revamping and looking at those kinds of areas. I mean, in some instances, it will just be a question of tightening up the institutional framework. Because dispute resolution is not necessarily a function of labor legislative regime. It's a function that has been delegated to CMA and the Bargaining Council. And now we do have the independent dispute resolution agencies that also deal with the question of dispute resolution. So it's a function there. So before you tamper with the law, when in actual fact the problem may not necessarily be the law, but it might be in the administration of the law, then you need to fix administration, not tinker with the law. So the duty is out in terms of, in some areas you would find that the intervention would be to strengthen administration of the law with all these institutional arrangements, rather than tinkering with the law. I think going to the law would probably be the last resort when everything else has failed. Labor market flexibility and inflexibility. I think your argument, honorable member, is that our labor market legislative regime is more flexible than it should be. My colleague here from labor would agree with you, and I would understand why you would agree with that, that they are gaps. I think the classical example is broken casualization and so on. I mean, that does pose a problem. So in actual fact, when the labor relations, the labor legislative framework is arguing basically for two things, if you like. It is there to protect workers in general, but vulnerable workers in particular. So I think where we have huge challenges is not so much protecting workers in general, it's the area of protecting vulnerable workers. This is where you get your farm workers, this is where you get your domestic workers, this is where you get your casual labor, and so on. So that would be that category of vulnerable workers. I think where the law perhaps in the arguments of organized labor needs to be tightened up is in terms of ensuring that the net is broad, wide enough to deal with vulnerable workers. So that's where the law is failing at the moment, according to the gospel of organized labor. It's an issue that is on the table, that places on the table, and indeed the Minister of Labour is driving that issue. He's banging on our door, isn't it? Like, they deliver a deal on how we deal with this phenomenon. And it's hard, but it's going to take a bit of time. But I agree, it can't stay in that forever. We need to reach a point where we can say we sign off on it. And if we can't provide guidance to lawmakers, then government must govern. Where they would have to step in and provide leadership on this kind of issue. What is the responsibility of government? I think if you look at the Growth and Development Summit, we've made our responsibility as a collective on to address unemployment and job creation. Now there are limitations in terms of what business can do. There are limitations also in terms of what government can do. And one wouldn't expect labor to really come to the party on how to create jobs. They are not natural employment creators. But the labor market, the organized labor in South Africa has done something that is unprecedented anywhere else in the world. I think some of you members in here also made contributions. There was that one day contribution where you worked and contributed to a fund, a job creation fund. And labor is trying to become involved in a very creative kind of way in attempts to create jobs. It's unprecedented. So I have no knowledge of something like this in the world, where labor has basically come in and said, well, we want to play some kind of role in creating jobs. I mean, labor would basically play a role in terms of social accord or on by making concessions in kind in return for job being. The tension between the macroeconomic policy framework, or perhaps the economic, how the economy is behaving currently, and the labor market policies. The first thing is this economy is doing very well. Everybody says that. And I think we see evidence out there on a daily basis that this economy is doing very well. The difficulty, though, and it is creating jobs. This economy is creating jobs. The difficulty, though, perhaps is the pace and the number of jobs that are created. Our view is that this economy is still unable to create jobs to the magnitude that will help us to see the visible dent on unemployment. That's the big challenge. So on the one hand, you've got an economy that is firing in all cylinders, but which has difficulties in terms of addressing the socio-economic deficits in this country, perhaps at the pace at which the magnitude of the problem requires. So that's the first issue. Now, I think the second issue is an issue that is very much in the public domain right now, in terms of the interest rate or the monetary policy. What is the relationship between that instrument and development, employment creation? Now, that's a function of the macroeconomic policy framework. In terms of one of the things that the bank, the central bank, sees with inflation targets, dealing with inflation phenomena. Now, to what extent is this talking to the bigger picture, to the bigger quest to grow the economy beyond 6%? Government talks of a competitive exchange rate. What does that mean in layman terms? What does it mean? I mean, what are the nuts and bolts and the modalities of a competitive exchange rate? How does one then deal with the things that we have no control of in terms of driving this issue? So it's those kinds of issues where the best economy, as the president would be the metaphor, is doing extremely well. But the second economy is not doing so great. I mean, what do you do? I think some of the changes we see in government, among other things, is talk about the development of states, which is great, because it begins to bring in a new dimension on how do we deal with the population in the second economy and how do we move into possibly the best economy. I think on casualization is a huge challenge for all of us, but it's not something we could just simply wish away. We need to think creatively on how to deal with the issue. We may find that at the end of the discussion, we need not deal with legislation, because you are correct. South Africa helps in terms of crafting the ILO's recommendations on employment relations, but it's a different ball game. It's nearly an overarching framework. You need to go back and develop the modalities and the nuts and bolts of how we do this. Now that's the juries out there, and I think the processes that we're engaging in NetLab will begin to give expression on what exactly do we do. We may not have to amend the law. We may have to find other ways of how to manage the casualization issue. I mean, some of the things that are currently being dealt with right now is what role can Parliament Council play in ensuring that the benefits that accrue to permanent workers also accrue to your casual workers, as it were. Labour market flexibility, what is this anymore? You know, that's what these academics were, among other things, were charged to do. Show us where is this inflexibility or flexibility? At the moment, the sum total of the work that they've done suggests that we need to revisit the dispute resolution mechanism in there. And nothing more. I haven't read anything more than that. To say, make it easy to dismiss workers, because that has cost implications to the cost of doing business. Because at the moment, which I I have my concerns is that the dispute resolution mechanism is very long-winded. You could, I mean, in the classical cases, this Cosato's application to constitutional court, something that took 7 years. So this thing can go on and on and on. Now you don't need that because it's got cost. I mean, I think any NSF has paid way below $3 million just to get a case solved, and the worker's compensation is in no way in the region of $1 million, much, much less than $1 million. But they spend more money to fight the case, to fight the principal, than what was in the case, as it were. So the benefits the worker who eventually got reinstated are nowhere near the amount of cost that has gone into that, into fighting the case. So in that context, then they say, look, we need to find a creative way of making a dispute resolution mechanism more effective, as it were. The issue of what is it that we need to do, there are a number of propositions. I mean, the one proposition, for an example, suggests that what we need to do in South Africa is that the new entrants into the labor market should not necessarily be paid the same amount of money that would be paid to a permanent worker. So if you're a new entrant, you must accept a different entry level. And perhaps for a period of 12 months, you should not expect to benefit from the current labor laws. So the protection must be limited to a new entrant. Then after a year, you then graduate into the second tier of labor market, where you then all the benefits of the current legislative framework would accrue, as it were. Now, labor is totally against that. You can't have two-tier labor markets in this country. You have second-class citizens and first-class citizens. So it's an issue. It's an issue as well, but it's on the table. Say, let's look at the possibility of a two-tier labor market. In actual fact, when you look at the current situation, we already have a two-tier, maybe three-tier labor market system. I mean, if you look at casuals belong elsewhere. They are regulated elsewhere. We don't know where, but they are regulated elsewhere. And labor is saying we must deal with that by revisiting the law and tightening it up. So those are the two extremes. That on the one hand, labor is saying they can't accept the current state of affairs, that we have two-tier labor market system by default. So we need to deal with that issue. On the other hand, private sector is saying, well, this is a global phenomenon. Everywhere in the world, you would find flexible labor, casual labor. So how do you stand in the way to deal with, just so you simply just wish away, because it's a way of doing business. Because businesses have peaks and valleys. Today you need 10 workers, but tomorrow when you're at the top, you really don't need 10 workers, you need 5 workers. It's that kind of flexibility. And without the law actually hitting them. Then the last comment from me, the last thing from me is that the... The capacity in the Department of Labor to deal with all clusters, an issue that, I mean, you should have. Now, the easier way of dealing with this thing would have been to develop a checklist and have boxes. You have employment, a box that belongs to the Department of Labor that gets taken in all the clusters. To say, once you finalize a policy consideration, you must step back from the policy consideration and look at to what extent does it help us to deal with employment. If you think it helps us to deal with employment, tick the box. I mean, I think similarly, you could have a second box that looks at poverty. To what extent is the policy that the employment and economic cluster, when they take policy, once they've finalized the discussion, they pull out their checklist. If it's to what extent is what you've just decided, helping us to deal with poverty. If you think it does, tick the box. If the answer is no, tick the box and explain why. You could have that. That's an easy way of doing it. You stop doing it. But it's not going to work. You've got to have the warm body in there. You've got to have the warm body in the social cluster. That says, well, look, you can't discuss social cluster policy framework without labor being there. Labor is important.
needs to be able to interact and see the resonance between those policies and the labor market in this way. So it's within that context. So I chose to take an optimistic approach instead of a minimalist approach. A minimalist approach would have been to look at whether or not currently we have capacity in the Department of Labor. And I think if I started that way, I would have been discouraged to even raise the proposition. But I started the other way around, to say we need to be present in all the clusters across government, and then look at capacity. If there's no capacity, then we must take steps to build that capacity. But I think the capacity for me is not a big issue. It's the smallest of the challenges we should be worried about. I think the critical thing is to see ourselves in all these clusters. So this cluster has become so powerful, extremely powerful. I mean, once if you lose the debate at the conceptual level in the cluster, forget it. It becomes extremely difficult to engage with it later. So the best thing is to be there when the politics are being conceptualized. Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mkhize. We are looking at time very briefly, that we only have 30 minutes.
Thank you, Chair, I just want to make follow-up on two issues. One is around the issue of inflexible and flexible. I just want to check from NetLeg. What is there on NetLeg? What is NetLeg saying? Because if you look at in NetLeg, you've got government, you've got business, labor, and you've got community organization. Now I just want to check, what is an issue in NetLeg? What is the real issue? Whether this labor market is inflexible or flexible? What is the issue? Because there should be an issue there. The issue can't just arise from nowhere and not be an issue in NetLeg. The second issue, Chair, the issue around, you make a point around chronic unemployment. I want to check whether the intervention, that is in terms of skills development, why NetLeg is, it doesn't direct this kind of chronic unemployment in terms of intake. Because businesses, they have responsibility to create work. I know that business in most cases is profit driven. But the other issue, 2 weeks back we were in a conference. The business, they raised a very pertinent issue. They raised an issue around payment of levy. They say they are paying the levy, but government is not paying. I want to check why NetLeg, having this four-leg table, and NetLeg not driving that process to ensure that there is equitable driven process in terms of the skills development. Lastly, Chair, the issue around casualization. I wonder, because there are all stakeholders there in NetLeg, why, because also there is a Labor Relations Act, why can't we have a regulation of some sort? A regulation that will say labor brokerage. This is what you need to have before you enter into a business. Because in South Africa, there are so many businesses that have regulations. For an example, you can't be a property developer when you don't have the certificate to be a property developer. Why every Tom, Dick, and Harry wake up in the morning and put a board there, put office there, buy some old furniture, put there, and open a labor broker? So it means this is a business for each and everybody. And it's where you see employees being manipulated. Even if when you go to these stores that they have this labor brokerage, disease. You go there, you are buying there. You see these people, they have been abused there. People are doing their work in cashier. From there, they must pack the stuff in the buckets. From there, when there is a crisis, they are being shot. When you are there, you see these things. But why these four leg tables, that is neglect? Why are they taking long to come up with clear regulations to ensure that the labor relation is being strengthened? Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, Comrade Herbert, I'm sure some of the things you will respond in writing. I know that some of them you have really touched on that, especially that issue of inflexibility or flexibility of this labor law. We know that we also have, as legislatures, have an obligation, and that's where we have to come in. But Tony, if you want, you also want to come in, you may do so, because some of the issues does affect labor. Tony.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Can I just at the outset also say that from the side of labor, we're very pleased with the role that the Department of Labor has been playing in making sure that the laws are applied and that people feel the effects thereof. But it's in respect of that we should look at it more closely, because the reality is at the moment that there may not be sufficient capacity in the Department of Labor to make sure that the labor laws are applied in all of the areas. The basic conditions of employment, health and safety provision, those things require a lot more capacity. And it seems from our interaction with the department that it's the lack of funding that makes the lack of capacity restricted at the level of the sector. So we certainly want the Department of Labor and this committee to look at that a lot more closely. But the point about the NEDLAC social partners, as one of the questions that were raised, is born out of the fact that there are very different views amongst the social partners in NEDLAC, and it is exactly difficult to get to an agreement. But we'd like to see this committee and government take a much more firmer stand on what does labor laws represent in this country. Comrade Everett outlined earlier how the fine balance was struck and how the negotiated compromises affected what the laws were about. So you can't want to constantly attack the laws as business does, because business constantly goes and attack on the laws. It's so inflexible, there are all kinds of problems, and we don't hear government coming out in defense of the laws. Because the question of labor rights must be equal to human rights in South Africa. That's exactly what underpins the labor market regulatory system. So we've got to find a way to undo this constant attack under the guise of it's not investor friendly or all of the other problems, and government must take a stand on that. Government can't be neutral. So our plea to you is that you also engage in these questions to say that this is the outcome of the balance that is struck, and you can't attack the architecture. But there is many areas of the law that are problematic. For example, in the area of casualization, outsourcing, labor broking, and that kind of informalization of work. And many of it is just designed to circumvent the law, so actually to not have the laws applied to that work. Again, it's an area that government must address, because we must have an engagement amongst the social partners, but surely the objective of the law is to make sure that it applies to all of the workers who were the intended beneficiaries of it. So that's what we'd like to see. But ultimately, we'd like to make the plea that we've got to evaluate what the effects of the law are being in respect of what the objectives are that we set. Now, wages is a key mechanism of redistribution within the society. But if you look at the effect of wages and the income of workers, which has really declined as an aggregate level of income across the economy, then the labor market regulation is not addressing it. It's not making sure that workers are maintaining their level of the income proportionate to the bottom. Profit levels in the country have increased. Workers' wages have gone down. We can see that in the growing levels of inequality in the country. And so that must be a consideration that government and this committee apply when looking at what the effect of that is. Likewise, the levels of unemployment has grown tremendously. Whether you take government's national figures of anywhere between 25 and 30% of the figures of labor and other NGOs that talks about close on to 40% unemployment levels, a direct represents a national crisis that we've got to respond to differently. But Comrade Urban makes the point about how do we make sure that it's not only in the area of labor market that we look at the key elements of labor market failure. Because when there's those huge levels of unemployment, that must be seen as labor market failure, or even failure of the economy's ability to deal and respond to the challenges of our people. But for example, in the framework around industrial policy now, if the government were to regulate laws that said that before we exported raw materials, we were obliged as the corporation to add two levels of value add or two levels of processing. We export steel, coal, diamonds, gold, all of it to China, and we import high value added products. We have the electricity, we have the labor. If we added some value to it in our country, it would create huge amounts of employment. But it seems the choices that have been made is that the faster you can export your raw materials, the quicker Anglo-American appears, makes higher profit. But it doesn't translate into a profit, a social profit in the society. So we want to argue that we've got to talk about the questions of beneficiation, and their government must drive it. The question of the deal around the peers is an important move in that direction. It starts to say that our raw materials must be processed in the country and must create job opportunities. But the same opportunity exists in every other area of commodity exports that South Africa engages in. And so the government must make a stance on that and must make sure that the regulations contribute to that. The flexibility thing, I can only say one or two points, Chairperson, but there's a whole range of flexibilities that deals with a lot of the concerns that I think the honourable members have been raising. The bargaining councils all have exemption mechanisms for small companies that have difficulties. The question of dismissal within the CCMA has also been made more easier with the CONR provision and many of the others that have responded to some of the concerns that businesses have raised. There are mechanisms in the law that the businesses must apply, and then we must evaluate them. But the problem is that businesses are not taking up the exemption mechanism, but continues what can only be seen as an ideological war against the question of labor market regulation. They'd really like to see us have the same kind of legislative environment as they have in China, where workers don't have rights. Now that's not the kind of society we want to build. Even if we were to try and exploit workers anymore, we'd never compete with the level of exploitation in China and never be able to outprice the price of labor there. But that's not the kind of society we want to build. Wages is a key part of redistribution within the society. But Chair, I think from our side, besides saying that the department's done a great job, we'd like to see in those very specific defined areas that we find a way in which we can work more closely together and send a common message in the society so that you don't have this common refrain of contesting what the architecture is. Other side of those more general points, we'd also like to take up the offer of the committee to make more detailed submissions to you on the provisions of the report, and we'll submit that in the next few days for your attention, and you can no doubt circulate it to the ministers, to all the members of the committee. But we're thankful for the opportunity to engage with you and raise what we think are fundamental questions for our members. If we don't get it right on these issues, there's going to be a fight in the economy, and there's going to be more destabilization that comes about because of that. We would be unable to, as we start to see, any further undermining of the legislative environment that provides workers with protection. And sometimes our only way to defend that is by taking protest action. We think we have an opportunity now to firstly find common purposes on what are the broader values and objectives we want to achieve, and then to define the architecture and the regulations and laws to achieve them. But any moves outside of that, I think it's going to be very difficult for labor as a whole in this country to accept given the deepening levels of unemployment and poverty. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Karen Rach. I think your submission will be of assistance to us, both of you, because we'll be meeting with the department next week. And of course, what was said by Mr. Labuskagne is very important to say, what are you saying about this annual report? Or perhaps maybe looking at areas like the CCMA. We had the public hearings, and the issue of capacity was raised. Do you think that allocation given to the subcommittees, or especially the CCMA, is that efficient? And of course, in terms of inspectors also, inspectors are being trained, and are they leaving? Why are they leaving? Do you think really we need to have more allocation on that area? But can I give Ms. Anthony, you wanted to come in?
Chair, I just wanted to make a follow-up, and I agree that we don't have enough time to engage on this one. But maybe for net labor, can be a homework, you can respond later on this question. And the question is really trying to check the balances of the economic, the booming economic growth that we are experiencing. And the question is related to the question of emergerizing growth. Whether our economy has got the potential to develop into an emergerizing growth. Given the gaps that are identified in the labor market. Just your analysis on that. I'm posing this question to both of you because at NetLex you are hosting all the stakeholders and maybe an analysis can be developed around that particular issue. Because if our economy is growing, but later growing into a measurable growth, it means that there's a deterioration in the economy, which will later impact negatively on in the country. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sure if we talk about maybe the renewal of this labor market, really the issues that have been raised by members, the issue of casualization is a problem of labor brokers. What should be done? And what do you think us as legislators can do around that area? Because that is one of the key challenges. Babu?
Yeah. I think we need to find time with both COSAT and NEDLEN and discuss casualization and the disabled brokers. Discuss that only. And hear from them what is their opinion. How do they think we can assist in this, because this casualization and labor brokers, they run roughshod over our workers. We can't just leave it like this and say, one day, the government must do this, maybe one day. But who is the government? Yes, the thing. We must, because we made it possible to have this, the present labor legislation. And we must also improve it. We must ask who will improve it. Maybe COSAT and NEDLEX and leave business aside, because business are going to make a lot of noise. We'll need a lot of things. They don't want to change. It's okay to them like that. Every meeting between these three, ourselves and COSAT, I think we need to have that meeting. They must give us a chance.
Yeah. Thank you, Babu Chan. It's an unfortunate that we don't have business with us today. Maybe they would really give us some ideas of what is their thinking. Babu Mkhonji and Ms. Rajwali.
No, thank you very much. I just want to ask, in particular, maybe from COSAT. You know, perhaps to advise government on the strategic intervention. My problem or my challenge is one that government is spending lots of money on skills development. But at the very same time, workers are losing jobs. And it becomes a responsibility of government to retrain these particular workers to be active in the economy. You find that business does not invest in the workers on skills development. Now, when they are being dismissed, they are becoming useless in the society, and then they must be retrained. I want that could be the strategic intervention that government, I mean, should do. We are going to train people endlessly, and we are going to use bigger budget only on training. Because if you can see, since the first conference of skills development, we have been talking about skills. At the very same time, workers are losing jobs in their fingers. So what could be the strategic intervention of government in that particular area?
Are we training them for the sake of training, or are we training them to be absorbed by labor? Mom, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. This is my question on the now, this is the friend who this is fine. It's actually making money. And it's going to be for the same thing. I just want to know from you, what monitoring system or time check has been made in the community.
Thank you. Any one of you guys?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the one thing that must also be, at the risk of being clubbed by my friends on my right, not politically, is that, organized labor must start organizing this casual work. We've got to find a way of how to organize that. Because one of the reasons these casual workers do not enjoy the benefits that are enshrined in the law is that they have nobody to talk for them. Because they're difficult class to organize. But I think we need to say to our state union friends, come up with some creative ways of how to bring the casual workers into the loop. And perhaps in that way, the two-tier labor market and what is often referred to as super exploitation of these workers may come under check as it were. So it's an issue that one needs to look at. Now in terms of these workers, how long they remain casual, they can be casual in perpetuity, forever. There are cases where workers have been casual for over 15 years. They can be a casual forever. Because the bottom line, the harsh reality is that the employer is not going to employ you full-time when there is no job for you. That's the harsh reality. So if the business is going through the valley, what is the logic of that business, employing more than the people that they require? It's a difficult balancing act, because you can't just say business is talking nonsense when they say, look, we don't need them, because the business imperatives just don't require us to employ so many people. But we know that December time we're going to need them, so perhaps that's the time we should employ them. It's more like in the agricultural sector, seasonal workers only come in during harvest time. When it's growing time, then they are not in the loop, as it were. So it's those harsh realities that we need to grapple with, which in a sense begins to explain why it's so hard in that leg to get a deal quickly. But there are some ideas, Mabunza, coming to Melela now. What were some ideas with how do we think we can deal with some of these issues? There are ideas of how to deal with it. Because not all labor brokers are bad. Not all of them are bad. Some of them are not as bad as we may think. But the problem is that there are practitioners out there who are so terrible that they end up, giving the bad reputation to the entire industry. Even the good guys become bad guys. But we must find a way of how to deal with the issue. And then skills development. I think that the whole system of skills development is under review. And then one of the things that has given rise to even more sharper focus on the way we're dealing with skills development in South Africa is the advent of the industrial development framework, policy framework. That has basically raised the question of we need to align. We need to start developing skills that are needed in the economy. So perhaps the reason why we keep on training people, and yet they don't get absorbed in the economy, maybe we're developing skills that are not required in the economy. So the need and just churning out skills for the sake of churning out skills is an issue that we need to look at quite carefully. And it's a very complex system of the CETAs. A very complex system. It's not as simple. I think it would be unfair to say business is not investing on skills. because they do. And data is out there that shows that business is indeed investing on skills. Now, you've got to understand that skills are one of the competitive advantages for businesses out there. So for their own internal skills, the businesses are investing huge amounts of money to develop skills that are pertinent to their own establishments, to their own businesses, because it's an absolute prerequisite for them. Because if they don't do that, skills are going to move to other areas. So it is a competitive advantage. Now the problem with the CETA system is that it assumes that all of a sudden businesses are friends. They can sit together and discuss strategic issues. These are competitors. These guys are competitors. So the likelihood might be that the skills that we're training are not actually the skills that are required for the economy. Yet if you look at the source of information on what skills needs to be trained, it's actually the very same sectors and businesses that will tell seekers what skills they need. So then the question is, if the finance sector says we need these skills, but once those skills are trained, the finance sector is not absorbing those people, then there's a big anomaly there. We need to revisit that. And I think the last comment from me is it's precisely in the area of the gaps in the system, and I think it's important that we need, as policy, as lawmakers, you need to get the labor perspective on the matter in terms of where they come from in dealing with this particular issue. And of course, without losing the fact that trade difference must also be strong, they need to organize. Organization can't be left to the law. The law is not going to organize for them. The law will set the floor. But bottom line is that they need to go out there and start organizing workers into their form. But by and large, I think the given all the challenges out there, the Department of Labor is doing an excellent piece of work. And I think in South Africa we are lucky that the Department of Labor is equal to other departments. In other countries, the Department of Labor is like a teaching office and lesson. But we're lucky here that at least we can influence the thinking within government. We can actually influence the policy architecture going forward. So that in itself is an opportunity that we need to seize and hold hands while we still can, as it were. So I think there are a lot of challenges out there. There's some progress in some areas, but there's still a lot of challenges, because as long as the unemployment in this country will be reduced, the industrial policy framework helps us also in terms of telling us in which areas should we be developing skills, and what should be the prerequisites for government to make available incentives to businesses on the basis of job creation and so on. So there is a need, actually, to look at the whole criteria of how to monitor that these things are done. So, Chair, I think going forward, the whole notion of ensuring that the policies that we put in place are achieving the objectives for which they were set out is absolutely critical for all of us, and we need to start investing a lot of energy in that area. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mkhize. This has been really a good exercise to us. It has really given us the in-depth of what is within labor. And I must say, even if you feel that labor department is doing well, I think you should be also on their side when advising them on some of the issues that are of concern to us, issues that brought them to be given the qualified to report. I'm sure you are able and you can do that to assist them, because it has been a concern on our side. Why are they, even if they are trying so hard, but getting qualified reports for so many continuous years. But anyway, thank you for coming, and I think in future then you would exactly know what is expected from you and with us members with our engagement. I think this was really good, and you are all invited for lunch. At if we can just proceed quickly to, is it here? Or it's outside here. If you can just have something before we proceed to the chamber. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.